What happens when a criminal defendant's case gets lost in the ruthless office politics among local and state judges? In this week's Case in Point, profile of the criminal justice system in the United States, a 30-year sentence and years of futile attempts to clear his name was the result. Clifton Dwayne Harvin was charged in the 1990s with sexually abusing his young daughter, a charge he's consistently denied with the support of polygraph tests. But acting on the advice of his then-lawyer, Harvin pleaded no contest in exchange for a 10-year probationary sentence and the promise he thought that he'd be able to retroactively prove his innocence. While on probation, Harvin was found in possession of a controlled substance, though, and the court revoked his probation and sentenced him to 60 years in a Texas prison for the underlying crime, which he continued to deny. Finally, in 2010, his daughter, known only as A.H. in court documents, swore under oath that her father was innocent. Yet Harvin remains behind bars in Texas. Andrew Cohen is the author of the Marshall Project's Case in Point series. Lillian Hardwick is an attorney and co-author of the Handbook of Texas Lawyer and Judicial Ethics. Hardwick says this was a case of bad advice meeting even worse judicial conduct.
He thought he could basically prove his innocence down the road. That seemed to have fallen on deaf ears as he tried to do that later on. Even though nobody truly disputed that, and even though there wasn't anything in the court record to dispute that.
So, we normally think of there's a trial court, and then there's an appellate court, and then there's maybe a Supreme Court. You know, in this particular case, he thought that he was going to find a judge that would undo his deal. And instead, Andrew, as you tell the story, he was getting himself more twisted into a situation that would result in his incarceration essentially for life.
That's right. And one of the other sort of components here that's so striking is the level of conflicts that were involved. The first attorney he went to said, sure, I'll take your case. And it was basically they were going to go down to the police station and do a polygraph. And by the way, Harvin, the defendant here, passed 3 polygraph tests. So he arranges with this lawyer to take the polygraph test. The lawyer doesn't show up. He doesn't take the test. Turns out the lawyer, the defense attorney, becomes his prosecutor in the same case. That evidently is not a conflict enough to warrant some sort of a new trial. Then at another point, he gets the other lawyer. This is the lawyer who tells him to take the plea deal. That lawyer later was disbarred. On top of sort of the procedural stuff going on, you have these conflicts that all of the courts are recognizing, but then they're at the same time saying these conflicts aren't enough for us to do any justice to this man.
Lillian Hardwick, clearly there were attorney failures here, but how did that translate or work its way up the chain to involve judges?
Mr. Harvin's very first lawyer became the judge of that court. So that was error number one. Error number two was a lawyer that he actually encountered out in the hallway of the court who volunteered to represent him for a sum of money when reportedly the trial judge would not appoint Mr. Harvin a lawyer. This lawyer had problems with effective assistance, and although that was not clearly determined in the case of Mr. Harvin, it may be that there were some disciplinary issues with regard to him. But the fact is that lawyer was ultimately disbarred for ineffectively assisting individuals in other types of cases. His third lawyer, he was determined to have provided ineffective assistance of counsel on the appellate level. So you keep hoping that some successor lawyer will do what the other one has not done, that is, do his job for the client.
Now, this is an unusual case, Andrew, and we should stipulate that. But the window that it opens here is that when you get to the appellate level and there are attorneys who have made mistakes, the defendant can get lost as the judges sort of clean up their own messes here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Too often, appellate judges excuse the shoddy work of lawyers, and too often, I think, appellate judges excuse the shoddy work of lower court judges. Over and over again, these appellate judges went back to these lower court judges and said, you're not justifying your rationale enough. You're not answering the questions we have, basic questions about the case. You need to do a better job. In the end, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, the highest court, essentially gave up and said, all right, we've had enough justification. We're comfortable with this 60-year sentence for this man, but it's not the way it's supposed to work. Usually in cases of injustice that we talk about in America, there's some sort of abuse of the process. Here, the whole process itself was turned on its head in a way that I think results in an injustice.
What do you think will be the final outcome here, and what's the prescription for court systems around the country?
Here's what I think should happen. And first of all, I mean, you can say, yeah, there was a problem with the judge at the trial level and probably even the prosecutor at that level. And so your check and balance on that is that when it gets sent back down, let it go to a different judge. Well, magically, that actually happened here because the trial judge and the prosecutor were smart enough to distance themselves from this case. And they said, well, this ought to be assigned to somebody else. We shouldn't have anything to do with it, which was exactly the right analysis. And I was very hopeful because it was assigned to a senior judge. And I thought, well, gee, why is this judge dragging his feet when the Court of Criminal Appeals has three times asked him to do something? It didn't make sense until I realized that he actually retired from the bench in 2004. So he was sitting by assignment. In some sense, you could view that as favor from the administrative judge of that particular region when this case was coming back to him, actually asking him to make findings that might reflect negatively on the first judge. So my hope is that if this case somehow gets to a position where Mr. Harvin can have his error-free day in court, and I'm quoting from Justice Meyer's dissent in saying that, I hope that it's in a totally different administrative judicial region outside of the triad counties of Montague, Clay, and Archer.
An error-free day in court. That's all this defendant wants, right, Andrew?
That's right. And the other thing to say, maybe the final thing to say, is Justice Lawrence Myers wrote this stinging dissent and said, you know, we're the same court that gave relief to Governor Rick Perry when he was a defendant. We were the same court that gave relief to Tom DeLay when he was a defendant. We sort of contorted ourselves and our jurisprudence to give relief, and yet we can't find a way to give this man the relief that he's asking for because he's not politically connected. It was a very powerful dissent. And what happened to Justice Myers? He was voted out of office last month. He was up for retention and he was voted out. So he's no longer going to be on the bench if and when this case comes back around.
Andrew and Lillian, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You're welcome.
Andrew Cohen is commentary editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. Lillian Hardwick is an attorney and co-author of the Handbook of Texas Lawyer and Judicial Ethics.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.